the Radio Ranch in beautiful Sugar Land, Texas, where life truly is sweeter. It's the Bombastic Blogcast for Tuesday, February 27th, 2024. I'm the G-Man, Dan Gallo.
Hey, G-Man.
Hey there yourself. Defender of the peace, keeper of the justice, purveyor of truth, and one heck of a nice guy. Let's get things started officially with
the Daily Denogram.
Yep, got to do the Daily Denogram for sure. And this is a good one. It says, learn to listen. Opportunity often knocks softly. Yeah, that's true, unfortunately. Why can't it just learn to use the doorbell or the phone?
Get off my phone, you jerk!
Let's move along now to the so-called educational part of the blogcast. Here we go.
Twisted history.
Yep.
Gather round, kids, because a lot of things happen on this day throughout history.
I know.
Some cool, some not so cool.
Big stuff.
Just the same. You need to know your twisted history.
Yes, you do.
You might be quizzed.
So there you go. Well, kids, it was on this day in 1922, a challenge to the 19th Amendment to the United States Constitution, allowing women the right to vote, was rebuffed by the Supreme Court of the United States in Lesser versus Garnett. We should probably note at this time, too, that all the justices were married. And it was on this day in 1951, the 22nd Amendment to the United States Constitution, limiting presidents to two terms, was ratified. Apparently, it was discovered that if a president's allowed to stay in the White House more than two terms, he or she can end up doing way too much damage.
God help us.
I love CPAC. And when CPAC meets, I think it's a four-day event. It's a Thursday through Sunday kind of a deal. And last weekend was their big weekend. And one of the speakers at CPAC was none other than the president of El Salvador, the current president, Nayib Armando Bukele Ortez. Young fella, born in 1981. And he seems to have his finger on the pulse of what's really happening in our world, our American world. And he, as president of El Salvador, has faced a lot of the same problems that we're experiencing up here in the States, and at least he's done something about it. What really amazes me is that our media doesn't talk about George Soros. And they don't talk about George Soros because they love him, our mainstream media. You can hear plenty about George Soros if you listen to conservative talk radio. Even Fox News Channel once in a while drops his name. But he is far more influential and far more dangerous than anybody other than Glenn Beck has been able to articulate. Now, the other day, Glenn Beck did a piece on his show about George Soros buying a major share of the Odyssey Broadcasting Company. Odyssey, which is the number two largest holder of radio stations in the United States. They're number two behind iHeart. Now, iHeart owns a lot more stations than Odyssey, but Odyssey just recently declared bankruptcy, so Soros just swooped in to scoop up a huge portion, I think about two-thirds of Odyssey. Now, there are a lot of conservative talk stations that are owned by Odyssey, and you can pretty well bet that's going to stop. There will be format changes. Plus, Soros just recently bought a chain of radio stations that are Spanish language. So, I mean, we're talking about a man who's got the money and the wherewithal, even in spite of his age, the guy's way up in his 80s, to exert a lot of his personal far leftist ideology onto the rest of us. And I'm very uneasy about this. I know you must be too. I mean, anybody who's not paying attention to this really isn't paying attention to much of anything worthwhile. This is important stuff. This affects you. It affects your kids. It affects your grandkids. Worse, it affects the very direction this country is going. This open border down there, who do you think's behind that? It's not just Barack Obama. It's Barack Obama's good buddy and the Clintons' good buddy, George Soros. And although George Soros has semi-retired from the organization, leaving his son Alex, who's not really that bright a bulb, in charge of things, and let's not forget that Alex Soros now is dating Uma Abedin. Remember her? Hillary Clinton's good buddy? Well, the the direction this country is headed under the influence, the incredible influence of George Soros, it's not a road you want to go down. Trust me. So, at the CPAC convention the other night, President Bukele, the El Salvadoran president, Nayib Bukele, got up and had some interesting things to say about the billionaires, not just Soros, but all the billionaires who are exerting influence on our political system here in the United States.
They don't have a democratic mandate. If they want a seat in the table, they should run for office. Let the people vote. It will not be a pretty sight for them if the elections are free and fair. I mean, who elected Soros to dictate public policy and laws? Why does he feel entitled to impose his agenda? Let me tell you something. Soros and his cronies hit a brick wall in El Salvador. Thank God, another glory be to him, Salvadorans are now immune to his influence. No one believes his lies anymore over there.
Well, I hope he's right. I just don't see George Soros as the kind of a guy to give up. If he's defeated in one country or another, I think he's just going to regroup. That's the kind of a person he is. I mean, really, the only thing that will save us from George Soros is the day he finally drops dead. But the way he's going, I don't think that's ever going to happen. That man's going to live well into his second century. Now, you couple that with what's going on the left or the Democrat Party, and you can easily get unnerved if you dig just a little bit, because buried within the mountainous terrain of modern political warfare that we're encountering here in this country, found some leaked audio recordings, though their specific origins at this point are still undisclosed, but they shed light on the machinations, the direction of the Democratic strategists and their benefactors. Pardon me, I didn't mean to call them Democratic. There's nothing Democratic about them. And the content of these tapes, turns out, is pretty remarkable stuff. Not for the mere presence of thought-out campaign strategy. I mean, that's kind of a given, right? But for the unapologetic way in which the individuals involved in this discuss the manipulation of the electoral process. You think 2020 was bad? I mean, what they're planning for 2024 is just unnerving. The conversations purportedly unveil the extent to which certain financiers, like billionaire philanthropists we were just talking about, are willing to go in order to cement their influence over the political landscape. And the tactics that have been exposed are, in essence, a manifesto of political control. So, what has been exposed are plans to shape narratives through mainstream media channels. In other words, using the mainstream media as a propaganda arm. But, you know, that's nothing new. It's just an even more concerted push because of who they're facing, Donald Trump. So they're aiming to destroy conservative policies and politicians through propaganda. And a strategy to galvanize their base through astroturfing, you know, stirring up artificial support on grassroots level. They've got the money to do it. And they also hinted at financial clout being used to steer voter turnout initiatives in a manner that benefits a single party. Basically threatening the principle of democratic impartiality. I mean, you have to face the fact that if you're over 50 years old, you do not live in the country you were born into. Campaign finance was also brought into the spotlight by these recordings. The boundaries of political donations were fiercely debated in these tapes, and yet there's, I don't know, their clear boundaries have been overstepped. which again is nothing new, but it's just being done even more so. It's more blatant, with large sums of money contributing to shadow campaigns and political action committees, you know, PACs. And financial leverage of this sort raises questions of policy influence and governance, and potentially undermining the voice of the individual voter. In other words, you. Now, Fox and Friends the other morning was in Columbia, South Carolina, visiting a restaurant, talking to the people there. And Larry Jones got into a booth with a lady, customer having breakfast. And he asked her what her primary concern is. And she said, getting rid of George Soros. And it kind of took me aback, because this lady was at least in her upper 60s. So she's hip, cool, and savvy enough to understand who George Soros is and the damage that he's doing to our country. Discussions that we must have in this campaign season. But getting back to these tapes, there were discussions on the tapes. I don't know why we call them tapes. They're digital recordings now. But anyhow, the discussions focused on a deliberate targeting of key demographics through social media platforms and on other online channels. Because by curating content and messages that resonate with specific groups, these strategists aim to create echo chambers, basically to strengthen one-sided narratives. And this manipulation of the digital landscape poses serious risks to the integrity of discourse and the authenticity of public opinion. Okay, this is all the bad side. But the good side is younger voters are finding it so hard to make it through a month on the paychecks they get. So many of them are living at home. They don't want to live at home. They want their own place. But it's beyond their means now, thanks to Bidenomics. So, unless I'm really way off on how I'm reading things, I get the idea that this time around, Donald Trump is going to have a great advantage with the youth vote. Some new developments have surfaced in the J6 investigation. I guess you could call it a game changer. A series of declassified emails from within the FBI have come to light, and they offer insight into the operations and communications that took place during a pivotal moment in American history, being called by the mainstream media an insurrection, which it was not. Certainly not by any definition of the word. But these documents, which have generated some discussion among political watchdogs and citizens alike, well, these documents present a scenario that requires, I don't know, closer examination, some reflection, some pondering. The emails in question unveil a complex, I guess you'd call it, tapestry of private correspondence among top officials within the Bureau. Nobody trusts the FBI right now. You know that, of course. And a close reading of the contents exposes some previously hidden dynamics here regarding the decision-making processes that were in play. It's becoming apparent that the officials were deeply engaged in the orchestration of responses to the events surrounding J6. Now, this showcases the intricacies of federal law enforcement operations under high-pressure circumstances. And I have a tendency to take National Lampoon look at the federal government whenever there's a crisis. You know, stepping and fetching, kind of like Keystone Cops. And I want to read for you a tweet from somebody called, formerly known as Stan, because he makes a great point here. And he says, calling January 6th an insurrection is just another liberal attempt to change the definition of a word for political purposes. And he's right. So then he attached this little meme to his tweet. It says, an organized attempt by a group of people to defeat their government and take control of their country, usually by violence. In other words, that's the definition of insurrection. Then it makes these points. It's not an insurrection if the Capitol Police opened the code lock doors. It's not an insurrection if the Capitol Police moved the barricades so the people could enter. It's not an insurrection if the Capitol Police waved the people into the Capitol building. It's not an insurrection if the Capitol Police stood quietly in the doorways as the people entered. It's not an insurrection if none of the people entering the building had guns, but the Capitol Police did. Now, there were two deaths that I know of, both of them female, among the people who entered the Capitol building. And, of course, the most notable death, well, they're both notable, but the one person we remember more than the other is the case of Ashley Babbitt, who was shot by Michael Byrd, who was a Capitol Police officer. There was no reason he should have fired his weapon. I've seen that video over and over and over again, I don't know how many times, and it's sickening every time I see it. And yet Michael Byrd is back, not only on the job, he got a promotion out of the deal. Now, it's pretty clear as you dig through all of this evidence, not these emails in particular, this is a whole nother item on the shelf, but it's pretty obvious when you dig through all of the evidence that we've gotten up to this point, that the real dastardly mind behind this whole thing was Nancy Pelosi. Because Donald Trump offered her all kinds of extra security for that day. She turned it down. So he did everything he could within his power. She just very blatantly turned it down. She seethes at the name Donald Trump. The woman really shouldn't be allowed in any official position within our government. She's very unstable. And as you look at all this evidence and you see how the events of January 6th shook out that day, it becomes really apparent. The evil, dastardly mastermind behind January 6th was Nancy Pelosi. And of course, her minions, and she's got a lot of them. So there are a lot of crucial questions about transparency and accountability within federal agencies, of course. The feds aren't going to share anything they're doing. Not with you and me. We're not important enough. Remember, we're too dumb to understand. And to many, especially in the conservative community, the delayed unearthing of these communications is indicative of the obstructions to a punctual and full public understanding of the events. We still have hundreds of people who were arrested, not necessarily on January 6th, but since January 6th, who are still in prison. And they're not being represented. They haven't had their day in court. So these emails kind of point toward a level of bureaucratic complexity. And maybe there's a shred of incompetence in there as well that some critics argue could cloud the clarity and straightforwardness expected from public institutions. I think that in the end, the FBI is going to lose even more respect. And then you add to this the decision-making autonomy of these agencies. I mean, they do what they will. So for those of us who are cautious over the expansive government power, all the details within these emails are it kind of rhymes, doesn't it? All these details within these emails are an affirmation of the need for stricter oversight and more rigorous checks. And these agencies must remain open to us because by default, we put them where they are. So these documents, as they uncover the behind-the-scenes actions, these documents bolster the argument that federal agencies have very far-reaching influence, which must be accountable to us. Got to be balanced with the public's right to informed discourse. And the internal communication also raises discussions about the allocation of resources and prioritization within the FBI during a period that right now is teeming with tension and uncertainty. I don't think I've ever seen so much anger in our country as I see today. It was pretty bad under Jimmy Carter, but it's even worse now. So these emails, And the documents shed a lot of light on how the agency navigated this, the security challenges that were before them that day. Decisions, not all of which were sound, I'm sure, that carry weight, not just for their immediate consequences, but also for how they shape the country's law enforcement strategies moving forward. Look at where we are today with law enforcement in this country. We are not in a good place. Now, these emails serve as a critical piece of the larger mosaic regarding January 6th. They add depth to the narrative, which is just ongoing. And, you know, they provide fuel for those who've been dissatisfied with the mainstream recounting of events. You cannot trust the mainstream media. They will not call it what it was. They keep calling it an insurrection. It was not. Not by any definition of the word. And then as the conservative perspective often tries to push back against the ongoing narratives from the left, the addition of these documents to the, the groundswell of public knowledge kind of indicates an opportunity to reassess and potentially recalibrate the historical account. Because you have to wonder, 50 years from now, what are they going to say about January 6th? What are they going to call it an insurrection? So, I don't know, the unsealing of these emails, I see this as a very positive thing. You know, a testament to the ongoing, relentless pursuit of truth and integrity by those in the conservative media. I mean, these people are truly engaged. And this underscores the necessity for continued vigilance in the face of government overreach, and there's a lot of that. So, as the public, as the public engages in a forensic analysis of these documents, it's important to maintain a guarded optimism. Guarded optimism. I mean, should be optimistic, but man, make it guarded optimism that these disclosures might lead to reforms, maybe, that'll prevent overreach in the future. I don't know. I think if we're ever going to see that day, we have to have a majority in both houses. But you can hope. After her embarrassing defeat over the weekend, Nikki Haley is still running. And we call it an embarrassing defeat because she was soundly beaten by Donald Trump, beaten like a drum by Donald Trump in her own home state, South Carolina. Go figure. And yet she refuses to drop out of the race. Colin Rugg, I see his tweets all the time. He's the co-owner of Trending Politics, conservative publication. He's an investor, media personality. And here's what he tweeted. He says, just in, Nikki Haley appears to still be in denial after getting demolished by Trump in her home state of South Carolina. This is some next level delusion. Well, it's true. He said, in what should have been her dropout speech, Haley said she wasn't backing down.
I said earlier this week that no matter what happens in South Carolina, I would continue to run for president.
Good crowd.
I'm a woman of my word.
Now, I don't dislike Nikki Haley. It's kind of hard to dislike her. She's a sweet gal and all that. But she does seem to be pretty firmly entrenched in the more left-wing side of the Republican Party. In other words, the rhinos. And Donald Trump has even alleged very publicly that she's being financed by Democrats. Could this be the case? Well, sure. I mean, certain Democrats are going to want to contribute her campaign in the hopes that she would drive a wedge between the voters who have a tendency to veer toward Donald Trump, kind of split the party. Unfortunately, she's not that strong. I don't care how much money they throw at her. She's not that strong. So anyhow, MSOC-TV reported that Nikki Haley spoke to her supporters Saturday evening after losing to Donald Trump. Within a minute of the polls closing in South Carolina, 7 o'clock Saturday night, the Associated Press and the New York Times projected that Trump would defeat her in the primary election. Spoke to her supporters just after 8 p.m. and right there, you heard it. She's not dropping out. She's going to continue. She said 40% is not some tiny group. There are huge numbers of voters in our Republican primary that want an alternative. I said earlier this week that no matter what happens to South Carolina, I would continue to run for president. Yeah, you know, you heard it. I just wanted to reemphasize that. But behind that statement is something that she can't refuse and is the reason she won't step down. Money. What was it that... was it Rashida Tlaib who said it? Who said it's all about the Benjamins? That's what it is. The money's there. It's going to keep coming because the left wants to divide the party. And they think that by bolstering Nikki Haley, they're going to be able to drive a wedge between us. But it's not going to work. So she'll run as long as the money keeps coming. And the money will keep coming as long as Donald Trump has a shot at showing up on the ballot in November, because that's what this is all about. All these indictments, all of the lawfare that's taking place right now against Donald Trump, it's all in an effort to prevent him from showing up on the ballot in November. Is it going to work? Probably not. And I find it rather interesting that so many of the people trying to prosecute Donald Trump are themselves very corrupt, and the corruption is coming to light. Let's have some fun in the Comedy Corner with Brian McKim.
I think one of the things that's driving people nutty is politics. Myself, I try to stay away from politics lately. I'm going to pay no attention to politics. That's what I said. I'm going to pay attention to the things that mean something, that matter, you know, people. And I thought I'm going to get a dog, you know. So I went online. I said, oh, I'm thinking of getting a border collie. And somebody types in, you know, only if you can make Mexico pay for it. You can't get away from it. Is it the grocery store? Is it the grocery store? I've done my shop and I'm headed for the self-checkout, you know. And I get there at exactly the same time as this woman. It was a tie, dead heat. And she says, she was, this lady, she was 100% Native American. I know this because she was wearing a sweatshirt that said, I am 100% Native American. So we get there at the same time, and she says, oh, go ahead. I said, oh, no, go ahead. She says, oh, no, you were here first. I said, oh, no, you were here first. She says, are we still talking about the same thing? People ask me, are you a glass half full or a glass half empty kind of guy? I'm a comedian, so I'm both. I can't risk being either one. Give you an example. Had dinner at a Chinese restaurant. After the meal, they gave me a fortune cookie. I crack it open and it says, you will be reunited with an old friend. Well, that's nice. I hope he's alive. I'm engaged in a fascinating project right now. I'm restoring my boyhood home. All right, I'm painting my mother's dining room. Give me another example. Glass half full, glass half empty. I grew up in a large Irish Catholic family. Well, large, I had two of everything. I had two brothers, two sisters, two parents. There were seven of us. I was the last one on board. I found out once that somebody said to me that I was an accident. So that's a rather harsh way of putting it. I like to think of myself as the fifth of four children.
Get on out there and make it a terrific Tuesday. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on tomorrow's bombastic blogcast. Remember, no such thing as spare change, free lunch, or too much horsepower. And be sure to take some time today just to thank the good Lord that you're an American.
You mean that's it?
See you tomorrow, G-Man.